Good morning. Welcome to the United Lodge of Theosophists here in Philadelphia. Before we begin with our formal meeting, we did want to review a few Zoom procedures. We welcome all to participate. We just ask that if you are not asking a question or making a comment, that you please keep your microphones on mute. And if you need to get up and walk around to turn your video off temporarily so we can avoid unnecessary distractions. Also, for those who do attend the meetings at the lodge on Sunday mornings, we do ask you in advance to help us participate in trying to keep the environment a fragrance-free zone for the benefit of those who have sensitivities. The atmosphere we try to maintain here at the United Lodge of Theosophists in Philadelphia is one of impersonality. We find that anonymity is very important in this regard. And also, if you have a question or comment, to direct it specifically to the chairperson of that meeting. This is all helpful in us mutually understanding and trying to apply the principles of theosophy, and keeps the personality and its tendencies in the background and the philosophy towards the foreground for your understanding. We do have ULT joining us live. You can hear and see us. Okay, well, we have gotten through the initial introductory remarks at this point, so we will continue with our reading of the Declaration of the United Lodge of Theosophists and the presentation of the announcements. The policy of this lodge is independent devotion to the cause of theosophy, without professing attachment to any theosophical organization. It is loyal to the great founders of the theosophical movement, but does not concern itself with dissensions or differences of individual opinion. The work it has on hand and the end it keeps in view are too absorbing and too lofty to leave it the time or inclination to take part in side issues. That work and that end is the dissemination of the fundamental principles of the philosophy of theosophy and the exemplification in practice of those principles through a truer realization of the self, a profounder conviction of universal brotherhood. It holds that the unassailable basis for union among theosophists, wherever and however situated, is similarity of aim, purpose, and teaching, and therefore has neither constitution, bylaws, nor officers, the sole bond between its associates being that basis, and it aims to disseminate this idea among theosophists in the furtherance of unity. It regards as theosophists all who are engaged in the true service of humanity, without distinction of race, creed, sex, condition, or organization, and it welcomes to its association all those who are in accord with its declared purposes and who desire to fit themselves by study and otherwise to be the better able to help and teach others. The true theosophist belongs to no cult or sect, yet belongs to each and all. In keeping in line with these principles stated in the Declaration, the United Lodge of Theosophists, we here in Philadelphia hold two weekly meetings. On Sunday morning, the lodge opens at 10:30, and the meeting itself begins at 11 and lasts till 12. On Sunday mornings, we usually have a more formal presentation of the philosophy in the format of a lecture, such as this will be today, a shorter talk, allowing more time for questions, which is a forum, or a panel where at least two volunteers present views on the subject. Now, we are starting a new umbrella theme for the month of June, Practical Theosophy. And for next Sunday, June 12th, the subject is Realizing the Justice and Mercy of Karma. So it's not enough just to understand it intellectually, but to realize it and recognizing it operating in our lives. On Wednesday evenings, we have a study class in the Ocean of Theosophy. That class begins at 8:30 and lasts till 8:45. It is entirely a Zoom class. The assignments for the particular class go out in advance so everyone can prepare. Now, we have finished the Ocean of Theosophy, the text per se. For the next few weeks, we'll be in a review session, and we are using as the basis of review a book called Answers to Questions to the Ocean of Theosophy, which was put together by students based on ocean classes given back by many years ago by Robert Crosby. And at the end of that book, there's a section called the Supplementary General, which takes up various portions of the ocean reviews those. And although the topics or variants can skip around, it generally serves as a good review. Now, once again, the pages will be given out in advance, but just to mention the pages for study for this Wednesday night are page 229, Just What Is, to page 229 to 236, ending with the words of this plane. On Friday evenings, we have a roundtable discussion, which is perhaps the most informal of our presentations, although we do maintain that format of impersonality as much as we can. And for this particular time, we're using a text called The Heart Doctrine, which is a collation of articles written by William Q. Judge. And we are taking an article up for consideration in that work called Theosophical Study and Work. And it's quite a long article, so we've divided into three Fridays, and this Friday we will be taking up the second portion of that article, and as before, the pages will be given out. So these are the three weekly meetings, and of course, all are welcome to participate. All at work is volunteer. There are no obligations imposed or implied, whatever you may want to contribute in terms of time, service, money, platform work. Please contact the Lodge through our website email, ultfilla@aol.com. If you have any questions about how you can obtain printed copies of the Theosophical text, you can inquire at that email as well. So today, we are beginning this subject on practical theosophy. And the subject is discernment, discrimination, and critique. And although we may not recognize it immediately, there's probably no more practical lesson in theosophy than learning the nature of discernment, discrimination, and critique. They are all mental faculties of understanding. And in this talk, we're going to try to explore their differences and how they are so practical in our lives, and understand them in the light of the theosophical teaching. So there are the three areas we're going to try to focus on. So before we get into it, we did want to think about examples that help us realize how practical this is. So how often do we find ourselves in a situation where we hear or read someone or see someone even acting in a way or speaking or writing in a way in order to communicate to us a definite impression or idea? And we find that we know whether what we're seeing or hearing or reading, we know whether it's right or wrong. We know whether it's true or false, good or evil, real or illusionary. So this faculty to directly know what is right, true, good, and real about a subject or an act or an idea is what we call discernment. Now, suppose we imagine ourselves, or very often we find ourselves in a situation where we have two different objects or subjects presented to us, two different ideas, both appearing to be good and true and right and real. And we have to choose between the two of them what is the best way to act and think according to those ideas in this particular moment. What will be about the best results? So this is this faculty to actively choose between alternatives and will to act accordingly based on our choice is the faculty of discrimination. So we've covered discernment, which is direct knowing of what is good, right, true, so forth. And then if we have two subjects, how to know which is the best to act in a particular circumstance to bring about the best results, that's generally discrimination. So let's take a third example. How often we find ourselves in this situation? We're sitting around a dinner table with family and friends. One person starts talking about controversial public policy, a book or public figure. Another person starts talking about a shocking revelation of corruption, scandal, dangerous views and attitudes and actions of a prominent public person, official, or celebrity. And eventually it comes around to asking us what our view is, our opinion is. So your response, your faculty of expressing approval or dislike or judgment of what is right or wrong, good or evil, is the expression of the mental faculty of critique, or which very often falls into criticism. Now, if your response is based on the results of a detailed analysis and assessment for the purpose of better understanding the issue and to be able to better explain it and interpret it for others, it's critique. But if your response is purely on your own personal judgment and disapproval of the apparent faults in the person or the situation, that's criticism, personal criticism. So although the words sound the same, the functions are completely different, and it is easy for there to be a blur and one fall into the other. So we do want to go along with that and make those distinctions. So what, having presented discernment, discrimination, and critique, let's start looking at it from the theosophical perspective. So discernment then is the ability to see what is true, right, good, real. But when we look at it from a theosophical perspective, we're looking at what is universally good, universally true, universally real in all situations, in all times, in all places. And that would be called spiritual discrimination or spiritual knowledge, because the quality of spirit is exactly that. It's universal. It applies in all situations impartially. It's not limited by time and space. So that is knowledge of that supreme presence in all things, seeing all things in the self and the self in all things. As it's stated in the Bhagavad Gita, spiritual discernment or true discernment perceives in all nature one single principle, not separate in the separate object seen. So it's a discerning power of the highest intellection, and it's the power of judgment through direct knowing. And from our teachings of theosophy, we understand that to be the activity of buddhi in our nature. Buddhi is the Sanskrit term for that human principle that we're talking about, that power of spiritual discernment, direct knowing. So discrimination then is a little bit different from a theosophical perspective. It is the faculty of doing the right thing at the right time and in the right place on every plane of action. So obviously it requires a knowledge and a point of view that covers the whole of nature, that leaves nothing out and no being out. And we might say that that kind of knowledge, which gives us that spiritual discrimination in what to do, is of three sorts, and you'll see that they are applications of the three fundamental propositions of the philosophy of theosophy. And one of those fundamental pieces of knowledge is to know that all things, changeable and perishable, proceed from one source, one spirit, whatever we want to call it, which is changeless and permanent. So to each being is an expression of that one spirit evolving along the same path under law. And the third idea that we need to know in order to have spiritual discrimination, how to do the right thing under all circumstances, is that all human beings are inherently perfectible. And that which seems to be imperfect exists only in the acquired, changeable, lower nature. And it can change, it can improve. So whereas we use that faculty of buddhi to discern what is true, and whereas the thinker uses the faculty of mind to know and figure out what to choose and how to act when there's two possible possibilities based on knowledge, that operates through the faculty of manas, or mind. So now we come to critique or criticism, and we wonder, well, what faculty is operating there? So we take a look at critique, and first we'll look at it from the point of view of criticism. So when we use critique and the object of our critique is another person, it becomes criticism. It is a faculty of judgment, usually primarily and for most often involving our own personal approval or commendation of another person's actions or character. And we judge it as them or their actions as being good or evil, right or wrong. It is strongly influenced by one's desire, and the result of that judgment very often is that in the comparison with oneself and the other person, we most often find ourselves disapproving of the other person. And critique or this kind of criticism is rarely directed towards ourselves in a constructive way, but it can be, and in this case, its nature and its results are different. Now, obviously, we know that critique can have another application. We can a critique or what we call intellectual criticism may involve a sophisticated, detailed analysis of the faults and strengths of a artistic or literary work, a policy or a thesis. But even here, our activity of criticism, even in intellectual things, is very much influenced by our personal bias and preconceived notions. So it should become aware that this faculty of mind or reason proceeds from what we call the lower mind, or that mind which is very much influenced by desire. So from all of this, we understand that passion or personal desire can definitely influence reasoning faculty in critique, and especially when we criticize another human being. But it also can color and distort the use of our faculties of discernment, our faculties of discrimination, which proceed from a higher nature, from buddhi manas. And we did bring forth a few quotes from the Bhagavad Gita, where Krishna is teaching this principle. And we'll begin with this one on page 28. By this, speaking of desire or passion, by this, the constant enemy of man, the wise men formed from desire, the constant enemy of the wise man, formed from desire which rageth like fire and is never to be appeased, is discriminative knowledge surrounded. Its empire is over the senses and organs, the thinking principle, and the discriminating faculty also. By means of these, it cloudeth discrimination and deludeth the Lord of the body. They are, O best of the descendants of Bharata, at the very outset, therefore, O best of the descendants of Bharata, at the very outset, restraining thy senses, thou should discover this sin, which is the destroyer of knowledge and spiritual discernment. And then on page 126, he re-emphasizes this point. We read, that discernment which does not fully know what ought to be done and what not, and what should be feared and what not, it is of passion-born rajas quality. That discriminating power which is enveloped in obscurity, mistaking wrong for right and all things contrary to their true intent and meaning, is of the dark quality of tamas. So it becomes apparent to us that if we are going to have any hope in controlling this principle of desire that clouds our higher discriminative and discerning powers of buddhi and manas, we have to begin where we are in our lower minds and learn to deal with this faculty of criticism or critique, which comes from our lower nature. So we thought we might, as an exercise, do a critique on criticism to look at it, look at its elements, its nature, and its effects. And so we want to study, we want to do an analysis, so to speak, of its nature, the nature of criticism, as we commonly see it. And what we notice first is that when a person is criticizing another, their attention is directed towards the imperfections, faults, and weaknesses of the other person. Now, it's possible that it can be directed to oneself, but that's more rare, and we'll get into that. The motive that usually incites personal criticism of another is often, it doesn't have to be, but it's often incited by spite, anger, or the desire to appear to oneself or others to be better than the person criticized. Or it may be a mental bias or prejudice, but even there, the principle of desire is active because our own personal views we prefer over those of another. So it is usually very partisan and personal. That's its nature. And there are typically a few, several justifications that the person who is criticizing or using this faculty on another states to themselves or believes to be true to justify their act of criticism. And they sometimes believe that they are actually performing this criticism and it will be helpful to the service of the other person, or it will be in the service of truth. Or they might believe that if they don't criticize the other person, they will be judged by other people as being in sympathy with the views and acts of that person, responsible for their continued holding on the same views and acts, or responsible for any actions in the future of the other individual based on these views. So for various motivations and justifications, people feel compelled, or it's a general tendency to criticize other people. So let's just take a moment and look at what the effects of criticism actually are, first on oneself and then on the other person. So what are the effects of one who criticizes the faults of others in a personal way? Well, for one thing, if you're continuously looking at the faults of other people, individually or collectively, you tend to get more cynical, anyway, about human nature and human beings. And also, the more you do of that, the less attention you're putting on yourself, because you already believe that you're better than the other person. And you spend less time in cultivating the virtues and examining yourself. So over time, there develops an increased sense of separateness from others and an increased sense of pride. So there's some of the common effects of the actions of the results of criticism on the individual who's doing the criticism. Now remember, one of the justifications is that by criticizing another, we're helping them. So we need to critique that and look at that more closely. What are the effects on the person who's criticized, another human being? And we might say that the effects are not what we expect. That it more likely than not, it results in anger, resentment by the other person. No amount of repetitive criticism or reminding a person of another fault is going to get them to a change or become wiser unless they recognize it to be a fault and they're willing to change. Otherwise, they tend to hold on pretty fast to what they believe to be true. We think the common expression that we see used a lot, especially when public figures are criticized, is they don't say, oh, maybe you're right, but rather they hold on to their views even more strongly. That we think the current expression is they double down and on their beliefs. And no matter how absurd it may appear to be, they seem to have more conviction, especially when they're publicly criticized. But if the person has already acknowledged the fault and wants to change, then rather than criticize, we find that what helps them change and get wise is encouragement and support and suggestions rather than criticism. So criticism there does not have the general effect we desire. So we wonder then, well, can our criticism actually be constructive? Can we constructively criticize another human being and or could criticize the acts of another, because we all come in contact with the good and evil, the light and dark in the world, and we have to make some type of assessment or understanding of it. But is there a constructive way to do it? Is there a theosophical way to use this faculty of criticism? And so once again, it depends on whether we're critiquing a person or an idea or a thesis. And so if we're critiquing a policy, the focus there is not on persons, but on the acts, on the principles, on the methods involved, and not on individuals. So we avoid any kind of condemnation of that, but rather an impartial view and study, trying to keep our own preconceived notions aside and really listen and trying to understand the viewpoint of another. And then when we have done that, then we compare it to something else. So this is a very important activity of checking, testing, and verifying, which is the process we use in our minds of critiquing. So it's very important, but we need to know how to use it. But suppose we have a friend or a companion or a family member who is really suffering and there's really a need, and we're aware of their difficulties, and they come inquiring for us for help, and we have to order for some constructive criticism. And there always, the idea is to, once again, focus on the act, not the person. And when one is speaking, to speak in a way that doesn't convey any anger or impatience, but generally a spirit of kindness. And if anything, we tend to feel more sorry, more sorrow, and maybe some suffering, understanding that what the person is going through. And so the added is a sincere desire, a genuine desire to want to help. And that's reflected in our attitude, in our tone, and what we say. And that can be very helpful and beneficial if we combine that with the focus on what is really needed for the person in the moment. So these are ways in which we can avoid using criticism in a personal, harsh, condemning way, but also recognize that we have to use that faculty of critique to test, just check, and verify what we hear in theosophy or what we become exposed to, how to do it in an impartial way, how to use universal principles to compare with particular views, and how to offer, and how to help each other, how to help one another improve, especially where there is a sincere desire of help and a sincere desire to receive help and want to improve. So we'll finish here with this thought that true discrimination, true discernment, true critique are very important practical aspects of the theosophical life. And when we see them demonstrated or coming to the fore in a person, they show themselves by the person being focused on doing good work, good helpful work, humanitarian work for another human being or others. When the situation arises, when the need shows itself, they're not necessarily constantly going out trying to improve the lives of others unless they're in their sphere there is a need and there's an obvious request for it. So they do what they can without any hope for personal reward, no demands, no expectations, but rather a desire to serve and benefit. And that's true, that's coming to something with a true attitude of knowing what's real, knowing what to do for the person at the right time in the right place, and knowing how to critique and understand what they're going through so you can better help them. And finally, with this thought, such an individual, when they come in contact, they're more likely to give the person a benefit of doubt, take pains, if you will, to give praise, to give encouragement where it's due, where it's earned, to focus on not understanding the difficulties, but give credit to what is worthy in the person, and to refrain from pointing out the faults and weaknesses for another. Because for most people, being constantly exposed to that can have a demoralizing effect and can be very dangerous, especially when that kind of criticism comes out publicly in gossip or slander, casual conversation. So we try to avoid that and practice that kind of impersonality, which treats everyone like we'd like to be treated ourselves. Do unto others as you would have them do unto you. If you really think criticism is helpful, just examine how the effect of criticism when it's applied to you. And if it comes to you in a very harsh, hostile way, you know through your own personal experience how the other person will experience it if you criticize them. So it becomes a practical lesson in offering encouragement and worthy praise where it's earned. So there's a lot that could be said on the subject. It's obviously something we've all gone through and faced, and we all have our own personal experiences and thoughts on that. But we did want to give some general theosophical insight into this subject. And so we wonder what kind of questions or comments you have this time. Yes, from ULT.
Yes, we were wondering about the faculty of intuition and where that would fit into this process. It almost seems as though intuition could affect all three, especially with the critiquing. But we couldn't separate, when we were thinking about it, we couldn't separate it from any of them. It just seemed like intuition is a basis for the decision making for all three ideas. Is that true?
Yes, we think that's true. Remember, when we were making distinctions between the three activities, we're all talking about mental faculties of understanding. In discernment, it's the result of that understanding being close union or contact with our Buddhi nature, which is not only the power to see directly, but the power to call on that accumulated wisdom, that experience that allows us to see what to do, what is right, what is wrong. And so it's based on observation, experience accumulated and stored in our spiritual nature. So intuition is very much involved with discernment, because it's that accumulated wisdom coming through into the mind and giving us a direct knowledge of what is true in the particular situation or discernment. And as we said, another related faculty is discrimination. The only difference there, it's pure manas. It's a choice. You have two options and you have to choose and know which of two to do in a particular situation. So it involves all those faculties of mind, manas, free will, self-awareness, the ability to make choices, responsibility for one's actions. All those things are involved. And obviously, if Buddhi or that accumulated wisdom can come through, we'll be able to make better choices. And we learn that through experience. And then, of course, to critique something in a constructive way, in a universal way, depends on our intuitive grasp of universal principles, our ability to apply those fundamental principles of theosophy in a situation. And some people intuitively know how to do that very quickly, and some people have to take their time in figuring it out. But intuition is definitely a factor there as well. So we think you're right. It's a separate faculty, but it expresses itself in different ways in those different functions of the mind. Really can't be separated from them practically.
MDW has his hand up.
Okay. MDW.
Yes. But we seem like we're submerged in a quagmire, because the whole world around us is critically minded. They find fault with everything. There's, even if we look back through history, we look at the faults of that. You know, that's just how we picture the world. And now you're speaking in terms of completely opposite. Rather than looking for the faults, seeing those things that are beneficial and helpful and encouraging and, you know, being helpful. It seems like it's a complete 180 degree turn that one has to make. You know, to be able to practice this, it has to be a mindful, you know, kind of every day, every moment. Because it seems that we're saturated in this attitude.
Yes. Good points there. Well, you know, if we go back to our declaration, we said, regardless of theosophists, all those who are engaged in the true service of humanity. Well, how do you know what's the good service of humanity if you don't have the ability to recognize intuitively what's good, true, and worthwhile? And how can you do that if you don't know how to help or provide service to a certain individual at a certain time without taking away their opportunity to grow or allowing them to suffer unnecessarily? That takes wisdom, that takes discrimination. And how do you know, of all the things you're reading and exposed to, all the things, suggestions on how to provide, how do you know if you don't discriminate and you don't critique what you read? So this is a session, this is a month on practical theosophy. How do we take theosophical ideas and, as you're saying, educate, uplift the faculties which now, the lower mind and desire, are very much directed in a personal, self-centered, and very often destructive way. And as we said, our faculty of criticism, if not checked, will be destructive, will be harmful on ourselves and others, because of the cause and effect relationship. We've tried to examine more closely what are the causes and effects, what are the motives by which people criticize, what are the effects, depending on those motives, of why we criticize. So we do have to change ourselves if we're going to make ourselves better able to help and teach others, make ourselves more fit by study and otherwise. ULT, we see a hand up.
Yes.
Oh, yes.
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought you said LP.
LP, why don't you go first, then we'll go back to you.
Sorry. When it comes to a criticism of yourself, we think two people could give you the same criticism. One you will resent, the other you will be grateful for. And the difference is, it's someone you trust. And you trust their wisdom as well. There was an older student who would give you a criticism like a pearl or a piece of gold. State it and then never mention it again. It was given to you as a gift. And that's when you learned you better take what other people say, even if you don't trust them, and use it as a guideline.
Well, this is true, but rarely do we trust that person immediately, unless there's been some experience with that person that we brought over from the past. But rarely in this one life, meeting a person for the first time, they earn that trust, and they earn it by, as you're saying, a general attitude of desire to help, of conviction, of sincerity, especially of kindness and concern for your feelings and wanting to help you in a way that's not going to make you feel shamed, that you have to defend yourself. And they earn your trust. So you recognizing that you have faults and you want to get better, you're hungry, literally hungry for that person's criticism, as you might be hungry for a meal by a cook that you trust and you know will give you good food. So these are all faculties that we can nourish, so we can become better helpers to give better advice and instruction to others and to receive it better. But critiquing yourself is also a great skill. Self-examination, self-study for the purpose of making yourself better is a activity of critique. We are using our minds. But to do it effectively, we cannot be personal with ourselves either. Or we'll find ourselves getting very upset, depressed, turned off, avoiding knowing the truth or ourselves, completely frightened of it. And it's a lot easier just to go on and not worry about it. Okay? So even critiquing ourselves, we have to take a higher attitude of discernment and discrimination. So we have to take the attitude of the observer, the witness, the experience. We have to discern in ourselves that there's a difference in us between what is real, eternal, enduring, the observer, and what is changing, our lower nature, full of imperfections, things we want to change. And because they're changeable, they can get better. So we observe them, and then through a process of study of how that lower acquired part of our nature acted during the day or responded during the day, we learn discrimination based on that higher perspective and universal ideas of what is a better way to act, and we practice it, and over time we develop that ability to know what is best for us to do in a certain situation with a certain person. And life gives us plenty of opportunity. So even criticism self-directed has to be from an impersonal point of view. And if we recognize that, how difficult it is to work with criticism, we will be more compassionate, more understanding of how careful we have to be in trying to help another through that same faculty. So we do see a hand going up under ULT. Is there a question?
Yeah, yes, there is. So constructive criticism is an art, maybe it's a science too, but we were thinking that unless we really do have the trust of another individual, probably pretty tough to effectively use constructive criticism with another. So we were wondering if in a situation that is doubtful, is it better to use the Socratic method of helping that person? Like Socrates considered himself as a midwife, you know, he didn't really claim to have a lot of knowledge, but he helped others come to realizations themselves.
Yes, that's a good point. It's so difficult to critique someone who doesn't, who has a different point of view or has opposing point of view. And a good and is certainly a wonderful exercise to really study the Socratic method. And you use the real wonderful analogy of a midwife. Well, the midwife doesn't deliver the baby. She helps the mother deliver the baby. So if our, the point of critique in this way, or this use of the method, so Socratic method is pure critique. It's pure exercise of the mind, looking at the objects and the way people act. And of course, even Socrates had to be very careful with who he spoke to, because he earned himself a lot of enemies, even there. So he had to be very careful with his students, and he was. But he basically, his method was, as you're saying, try to question people in such a way, work with them, that they themselves come to the same realization. They agree, they come to the same conclusion as the one you have. So it's learning to look at their assumptions and ask questions and make analogies. And it is an art, it isn't a skill. It's something we don't generally develop. So it's a lot easier for us to fall back into just personal opinions and so forth, which very often don't have the effect we desire. So lacking that kind of knowledge or ability to use the Socratic method or understanding of the issues involved, it is often better to refrain from criticizing and just offer understanding and praise and where the merit is due. It will help us if we have develop a real spirit of charity in general. If we develop a spirit of charity and we get rid of our own sense of insecurity, in other words, we gain real respect for ourselves, a real conviction in our own spiritual nature, understanding our spiritual nature, we will be less likely to criticize others. We're less likely to feel we have to act from a point of view of feeling inferior to others and make ourselves feel better. And that, so developing a real sense of self-respect will help us respect others, and exercising, developing a real sense of kindness and charity. All this will have the effect of helping us refrain from being so easy to criticize others until we learn how to do it with skill. Yes, LP.
Epictetus had a great answer for when you are criticized. Someone came to him and said, this person said these terrible things about you, and went and gave him the consensus. And Epictetus said, well, he must not have known about all my other faults. He didn't mention them. And we think that's a noble thing. But we think the hardest thing with criticism is when you're asked for it.
Yes.
And you don't know, is the person ready to hear the truth? Or do you have to cushion it a bit so as not to harm them? And we think that's a very difficult thing, because you don't know if you're being deceitful when you're trying to help.
Yes. So once again, the guidelines there for constructive criticism or another, generally as we have them from our theosophical literature, is not to critique persons or the character, but explore the principles, the assumptions, the ideas. And you do this best by open-ended questions, you know, trying to why do they do things? What do they see the result of being? And what do they expect would happen if they acted another way? And of course, so besides asking questions, once again, asking questions and doing it in such a way that does not make the other person feel ashamed, or because they will naturally, the human heart will naturally close up and try to protect itself, or lash back, get angry and resentful. And we want to avoid that. So yes, very often we're sitting around the dinner table and people are gossiping or talking, a very casual conversation about another. And you know, the tendency is to want to not speak in those situations, to avoid that. And so what are our choices? Well, we can either ask questions or direct the conversation to something else, or say, you know, I really don't know the situation that well. I don't know the person, the situation right now, and I just don't feel it's fair for me to give my opinion. I mean, we have to develop our own ways of doing this, but the principles that guide us are brotherliness, compassion, and an understanding of that everything we say or do has its effect. Every cause has its effect, and we want to act in a way that preserves that universal harmony, that unity, and does not throw it into discord. Because the reaction on ourselves and others will be pain and suffering, and we try to avoid that. Yes, ULT.
It's interesting, when the talk was started, the first thing that popped into our minds is that this just is reminiscent to us of the scientific method, where you look at something, see that there needs to be more investigation, kind of break it down into pieces, and then you critique, you assess how all your work in the beginning, how it all played out, and see what the results are. And it was just very interesting that we were comparing as the talk was going on, and then all the comments. It just seemed like you could almost, I don't know if you want to call it an analogy or not, but they just seem to be almost the same, but working like the scientific method works on the physical plane, whereas these three are more on the emotional and intellectual plane.
Yes. Well, it is interesting, though, that when analysis or critique is done in the right way, in the right spirit, with the right skill, it does lead to better discernment and discrimination. And once again, you break things apart in their elements, in their constituents, and you put them back together again. And when you do, you understand the whole better than you did before. As you said, that's what scientists do. They want to. If you want to understand something, you have to sort of take it apart, look at its elements, its cause and its effects and its laws, and then you put it back in the context with other things and you understand its relationship to others. Well, theosophy helps us do that. We look at ourselves, we are a unity. We are one. We are one with the all, but we are also a unity in diversity. And we better understand ourselves, we learn from exploring or developing an understanding of the details, the elements, the diversity. So we study the sevenfold principles of our nature and the sevenfold principles of nature around us. And by doing that and putting it back together, we get a better concept of the totality, of the unity, of universal brotherhood. Because when you think about it, universal brotherhood, when you first come across it, is a very vague notion. Maybe it's sentimental, but what it actually means is very vague until you take it apart and you see how all the parts work together and interact. And you see that universal brotherhood is a fact of nature. And then so you can put it together and see that you can see why the virtues and the attitude of the self and all, and the recognizing of the unity, of fundamental unity of life, becomes so important. So we say theosophy is not just a religion or a philosophy, it's also a science. And we've tried to explore that possibility today. So we did want to stop here and invite you, of course, next week. We are considering our discussion of practical theosophy, realizing the mercy and justice of karma in our lives. Also, it's going to require some examination, is it not? So thank you again, and have a good day.